So today I'm going to talk about game control, and I kind of put together like several different papers that we have published before about how sensitivity is altered by internal state of the animals. So yeah, so you are welcome to stop me anywhere, anytime. I mean, I don't have to finish the whole talk. I have 28 slides or something like that. So yeah, I don't have to finish. So we work on adults, and I didn't know that the sequence was organized by the age of the
It's not supposed to. It's supposed to be completely mixed up.
But if you don't have adults, how do you have the larvae? So the olfactory system in Drosophila is more, in the adults, is more complicated than the larvae. But is a lot simpler than the olfactory system in the mouse. There are about 1,000 sensory neurons. They send axon into the anterior lobe, which is divided by about 50 glomeruli. And projection neurons send information to the lateral horn and the mushroom body. And today I'm going to focus just on the anterior lobe, and Glenn is going to tell you all the other things that the mushroom body and beyond. So because the simplicity of the anterior lobe, it makes possible to come up with an experiment to ask the question that which glomeruli are for what behavior. And that is possible because that each of these glomeruli, they are morphologically stereotyped. You can recognize individual glomerulus by their shape, location, and size. So each of the glomeruli here has a name. So you can say, for example, this one is DA1. It means that it's dorsal anterior number one, and so on. And thanks to the work from Leslie Vogtschoh and Barry Dixon and Richard Benton, we have reagents to mark the sensory neurons of each glomeruli. And with this reagent, we can activate or silence individual glomeruli to address the question how they are relevant to behavior. So without going through the details that we just published, and you can read the paper as well, that we found that the attraction to apple cider vinegar, which is the fruit-like odor for Drosophila, is mostly determined by two important glomeruli, DM1 and DM5. So you can say that DM1 detects the positive valence in vinegar and mediate innate attraction behavior. As the concentration gets higher for vinegar, the DM5 is excited. So the DM5 mediated innate aversion and detects a negative valence. And
DM1 is deactivated?
the DM1 is activated and it mediates innate
No, I
attraction.
understand, but at high concentration, what happens?
At high concentration, DM1 is still activated. Yeah.
Is there a specific receptor behind each of these two glomeruli?
Yes. So the receptor for DM1, there's called OR42B, and DM5, that's OR85A. And there are several examples of this idea that anterior lobe pass out the valence information in olfactory stimuli. There's a CO2 sensing glomerulus here. It's called a V glomerulus. Express the receptor GR21A. It mediates aversion behavior. There are two other examples that Greg Su's lab found. The DC4 glomerulus here respond to acetic acid and mediate aversion response to vinegar that has a lot of acetic acid.
Vinegar is acidic.
It is mostly acetic acid, yes. But the but we have designed an experiment that in such that acetic acid is not that important.
So when you say vinegar, is that a different compound?
Vinegar, we bought it from grocery store.
But it must be a minority compound within vinegar.
Exactly. We haven't figured out exactly what's the chemical that excite the DM1 glomerulus. Yes. But the vinegar is also not all the same. So we kind of like bought like 10 different brands from a grocery store and then run all through the behavior experiment, and we found a good one, and we go back to buy like a case of that and store that.
It goes off at your supermarket and decide which vinegar to buy.
So another example is that the DA2 glomerulus.
Gene?
Yes.
For DM1 and DM5, so how does it work? DM1 is always up, and then as concentration goes higher, DM5 starts going up and depresses and does the ablution.
Yeah, so the sensitivity to vinegar, DM1 is very sensitive, and it's saturated at high concentration. DM5 is less sensitive, and it starts to respond only at high concentration.
The response curve is steep.
The response curve, you mean the slope?
Yeah.
They're very similar.
So it's just a shift in
Exactly. So there's another example that the DA2 glomerulus detects geosmin. Geosmin is the smell that coming from your water when is not is few. I mean, is it has bacteria. So geosmin is actually an odor that comes from bacteria, and flies also avoided moldy food. So they use these DA2 glomerulus, and that works from Bill Hansen's group. So from all of these examples, one can say that perhaps the antenna lobe already passed out the ecologically significant valence from odor stimuli. Okay. So is this a unique thing with Drosophila, right? When we started Drosophila, people always ask this question. In fact, this is not, because here's one example from Tom Boza's laboratory that they show that mice avoid the predators by virtue of these yellow glomerulus here, TAR4. And so when they silence these glomerulus, the laboratory mice that are no longer afraid of the urine odor from their predators, such as this animal here called puma. All right, so looks like this could be a general principle that the antenna lobe glomeruli or olfactory bulb glomeruli, they can pass out valence information to mediate innate attraction or aversion. So one can say that these glomeruli are genetically hardwired to generate innate behavior response. So, yes?
So, to the smell of vinegar, I mean, there's only one or two glomeruli that respond to the smell of vinegar.
Right.
Or it is the case that many of them respond, but then only one or two will convey the bivalence information.
Yeah, so there are many glomeruli respond to vinegar. Something like, depends on the concentration. At low concentration, you have two or three glomeruli respond to vinegar. At high concentration, you get to like 8 or 9, which is 20% of the glomeruli in the antenna lobe. But the other glomeruli that they do respond, they are not relevant to the behavior assay that we used. Whether those glomeruli are useful for other behavior aspects, I would say that they certainly are useful, but I just don't know. I don't have any data for it.
Good question.
Yes.
So do you think that it's inevitable? So say you raised a mouse with a puma smell.
Yeah.
Is he going to eventually kind of not, so avoid that stimulant smell?
I don't know.
If he gets it from bird kind of thing.
Yeah, it would be an interesting experiment to do.
Yeah.
That, and certainly that in flies, for mating behavior, people know that if you raise the flies individually in a vial, their behavior for mating is different from if you raise them in a group of flies. So I would think that the olfactory experience certainly would have some impact on their behavior. But in this particular case, I don't know.
I think it was shown in adult flies for CO2, like that flies raise that high level of CO2 will have a higher tolerance to CO2 afterwards.
Yeah, so your the paper you're talking about.
It's a neuron paper, I think, from 2008 or something.
Yes, so that was the example. So Matthew was saying that there was a paper from Leslie Voxel's laboratory showing that if you raise flies with higher CO2, their behavior response to CO2 is different, is reduced, right? Yeah, okay, thank you. So, all right, so since valence is imparted by glomeruli, if there are mechanisms to change the sensitivity, then we should see their behavior response to the odor will be different. So over the last few years that we have studied this issue that how internal physiological state such as hunger and satiety change olfactory sensitivity in the glomeruli, and we have seen two very common gain control mechanisms, and one is this additive gain control. So here's the response plot against the odor concentration in log scale. And a parallel shift here suggests that is additive gain control. On the other hand, this slope change would suggest that this is a divisive gain control. And these are the two common gain control that we have seen in the antennal lobe. So I'm going to explain that how that is accomplished and what is the behavior context. And what is the internal physiological state. So the first thing we did was that, all right, so here's behavior assay. How do we measure the attraction to vinegar? So we put a drop of vinegar in the middle of a petri dish, and we let the flies walk in the dish, and we measure how much time the fly reached the odor target. So if the fly is satiated, they don't seem to care. Often they walk on the rim of the dish. But if the fly has been starved, then they quickly zoom in to go to the source of the odor. And there's nothing there, there's no food there to consume, and they just stay for a little bit and they leave. So we make a plot of the percentage of fly that reach the odor target, compare the starved versus the satiated fly. There's a great difference between them. So we have a behavior assay now that we can measure how internal state can change the behavior response. And this 5% here is just noise level, because if you put in water, you will see about 5% as well. And this 25% at the end of 10 minutes, you may say that is very low, but that's because the concentration that we use, the odor concentration we use here is very, very low. If we increase the odor concentration, we will get to something like 75%. And you will see those data later. So we did an imaging experiment. So this
It means that the fed ones, it's not that they are finding it and going past, it's just that they're not going, getting there.
They're not getting there.
So, but if they do get there, the ones they will then stay there?
No, they will. It looks like they get there by accident. So then we did the imaging experiment. So here is the looking at the axon terminal of the DM1 glomerulus that mediate attraction, and we can compare fed and starved flies, and you see there's a parallel shift. So this will be considered as an addictive additive gain control. All right. So
that's a logarithm scale.
What's that?
It's a logarithm scale.
It's a log scale here. But the firing rate, okay, we can talk more about that. What was the?
I guess it's multiplicative with respect to concentration, right? So it perceives concentrations if it was multiplied. Okay, I guess you define multiplicative as firing rate multiplied by a number.
Yeah, so because we are looking at synaptic transmission, we look at the downstream neurons firing rate, in response to the firing rate of the presynaptic cells. We also look at synaptic transmission and all of that. So it is useful to plot that as a log scale for the odor. All right.
With respect to firing rate, but not the concentration. It's okay.
So we're looking at the external terminal calcium here. And so, all right, so that's the DM1. And so without telling you all the details, because I thought for this talk here that the details probably are not necessarily important, right? So you just have to take my words for it, how this happened. And we have experiment to show that each of the steps, it is very likely. So in the satiety state, that SHOMPF, this is the neural peptide that control the sensitivity of the neuron. SHOMPF is released, but there is no receptor to detect SHOMPF. On the other hand, in the starved animal, that SHOMPF receptor is made, and the autocrine release of SHOMPF would increase the sensitivity of the presynaptic terminal. And this SHOMPF receptor expression is controlled by the metabolic hormone insulin. So when you just have a meal, insulin level is very high. As you stop feeding, then insulin level declines. And the decline of insulin level allows the expression of SHOMPF receptor, because normally insulin suppresses the expression of SHOMPF. And this makes sense, right? Because you don't want to use glucose to control the expression of SHOMPF receptors, because by the time that your glucose level is low, there's no time for hunting anymore, right? You're finished. So it makes sense to have insulin. And the other thing is that insulin is probably the only metabolic hormones that have the ability to control gene transcription. That's not the case for glucose, that's not the case for ghrelin, and that's not the case for leptin. All right. So,
I see the red is a different neuromodulator than the black. What is the black?
The black is the neurotransmitter.
A neurotransmitter. What is in this example, the neurotransmitter, just for us to talk about it?
Yeah, for the fly, in most of the central synapse, the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine.
Okay, so we have acetylcholine and we have SMPF.
Yes.
And what is the influence, again, administered with insulin, going to insulin receptor? What does it do to SMPF?
So insulin, activate the insulin receptor through some signal transduction cascade. Yeah. Next is to suppress the expression of SHOMPF
of the peptide
receptor.
This one
here. I'm sorry, I'm pointing the wrong thing.
Okay.
The peptide receptor.
The peptide is always there.
The peptide is always there.
And it has vesicles.
Yes.
And it gets secreted.
Yes.
All the time. The only difference is that if there is a receptor on the outside of the presynaptic terminal, then the ligand SMPF gets to the receptor.
Yes.
And does what? Again, please.
We don't know what is the factor to change the excitability of the neuron.
But the excitability is postsynaptic.
The excitability is a presynaptic.
Presynaptic. So it's a secretion. It modulates the secretion of acetylcholine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And we don't know how.
We don't know how, but it's very likely to be sodium channel, because there's
who is SMPFR?
The activation of SHOMPF receptor probably make the membrane more excitable by regulating a sodium channel, and there was a study from Salamander. Showing that the olfactory epithelium neurons, that their sodium conductance is increased in the starvation state. And it's certainly consistent with the what we saw here is an additive, because when you put more sodium conductance on the membrane, you often get additive gain control. Yeah? Okay. And the Schoen-Pierre release is autocrine and is not able to diffuse from one glomerulus to the neighboring glomeruli. And we have experiment to show that that's the case. And there are only a few glomeruli that do express Schoen-Pierre, and their sensitivity increase with starvation. So that's the additive gain control that provide a mechanism based on a presynaptic facilitation to increase an appetitive behavior.
Can I ask a question? Yes. So the release of MPF, you think it's not really regulated, or would it be in some way dictated by the levels of activity in this receptor?
So you would say that, what we said, I have to be very careful here, what we said is that the release of Schoen-Pierre is not modulated by the satiety state of the animals.
Yeah.
And certainly that is possible that is modulated by, it has to be modulated by the, it has to be controlled by the activity of the terminal, right?
Yeah. So,
okay. Yeah.
Basically, calcium will release both the neuron,
yes,
peptide, and acetylcholine.
Yes.
In the same way.
Well, they may have different sensitivity to calcium. Yeah.
In the same way, irrespective.
Exactly. So the only difference that we have found is that the starvation state express the neuropeptide receptor. And the presence of neuropeptide receptor make the terminal more excitable, and therefore the terminal is facilitated.
Is this a mechanism that was first discovered by you ever in any animal?
It's very difficult to say never before. But the people who study feeding behavior in mammals.
I'm talking about the generality. That there is something that gains the presynapse by gene expression.
But is it gene expression or is
it's gene expression?
Gene expression.
Receptor gets the gene for the receptor gets activated.
But I'm saying it doesn't have to be a priori, where you could just have the receptors intracellular vesicles and you put it in just like you would have receptors.
Yeah, so we're not excluding possibility of translational control, receptor trafficking, but we do know that the transcription level is upregulated. That's all we know. Yeah.
So if it only could be two mechanisms that do the same.
Yeah, it could be. And we also, that often people ask me the question about, what about refeeding? When the animal just have a meal, what is the change in the Schoen-Pierre receptor? Are you going to wait for the receptor to disappear, or is the receptor trafficking? That we don't know, right? So
is it very new?
All right. So I just told you before that at low concentration, vinegar is attractive. As you increase the concentration, then they become more attractive. But if you increase the concentration further, they become less attractive to vinegar. Right? So there are two mechanisms here, apparently, right? And this is consistent with the common knowledge that we have. When you're hungry, French fries smell so good, right? And also the normally bad odor are no longer that repulsive. Right, so that's what we are after. So we asked a question
cat food sometimes. If you're hungry, cat food actually.
What? This is hungry likes cat food.
I think that's what he said. It smells.
We need to study you as an outlier. So we found that with comparing these fed and starved animals, in response to very high concentration of vinegar, only one glomerulus is different. So this is the DM5 glomerulus. It's suppressed by starvation. And this suppression by starvation is very interesting to us because DM5, and I told you before, DM5 mediate aversion behavior, right? So suppression of aversive glomerulus could be another mechanism to increase the appetitive response to food odor stimulus. So again, that without telling you the details, the history, how we found this neuropeptide that control the sensitivity of the DM5 glomerulus. Anyway, we found that is something called tachykinin receptor. Tachykinin is a big family of neuropeptide that includes the famous one called substance P. And you know that substance P and the NK1 receptor, the substance P receptor, they are somehow related to stress, related to anxiety, all of that. And in the spinal cord, that the substance P is one of the gating mechanism for pain response, right? So, all right. So when we knock down Schoen-Pierre receptor in the olfactory system, we saw that indeed, at low odor concentration, the attraction is completely abolished, just like what I just showed you. But the response to intermediate medium concentration, the fly still show some attraction behavior response. And on this high concentration, if you look at knockdown of the tachykinin receptor, their behavior is reduced. But that's not the case for low odor concentration, right? So we therefore thought that these two parallel neuropeptide modulation, Schoen-PF and tachykinin, are two parallel systems that modulate the sensitivity of two different glomeruli, and that control the starvation-induced behavior response. So if that's the case, then if you knock down both of them, you should be able to turn a starved animal to behave like they are fully satiated. And indeed, that's the case when we double knock down the Schoen-Pierre receptor and the tachykinin receptor, then starved animal behave just like they are satiated animal. Okay. So again, I'm not going to tell you.
Quick question. So one thing I guess you didn't emphasize, but it seems like it's necessary, is that the idea then would be that these receptors should be expressed in specific receptor neurons, because if they're everywhere, everybody's sensitivity will change.
Yes.
So I see.
That's the case. Yeah, that's the case. So I'm not going to show you the data, but the Schoen-Pierre, and by the way, I forgot to mention that Schoen-Pierre is a homolog of MPY. I mean, any mammal that MPY is the orexigenic neuropeptide that stimulates feeding behavior, right? So in the hypothalamus, when you're hungry, the ocular nucleus neurons, they release neuropeptide Y, and that's stimulating behaving for, I mean, the feeding behavior, right?
So sensitivity of the glomerulus.
Yeah.
It's somewhat a misnomer, because what you are gaining here is the activation of the glomerulus.
Well, the
activation of the postsynaptic neurons,
yeah,
whose dendrites reside within the glomerulus.
Yes.
Right? It's the sensory neuron activity that gets modulated.
Yeah. Because otherwise, I have to say projection neuron all the time, right?
Which is difficult, yeah.
Which is difficult. PN. So saying glomeruli is vague and also is easier.
Well, but it's a release from the axons that's turned down, right? Yeah. So in some sense, you can think of
it is within the glomeruli.
The axons.
Yeah. To me, when somebody says the sensitivity of the glomerulus, it means its capacity to receive signals.
So again, so I think in response to Vinky's question that it's very interesting that a lot of the sensory neurons terminal have GABA B receptor. Only a small subset of them express strong PF receptor. And another subset of them express tachykinin receptor. And I cannot say never, but it's very rare that sensory neuron of a given glomerulus express both tachykinin receptor and strong PF receptor. And I cannot say that with certainty because they don't have the slide that show the pattern of expression for the two neuropeptide receptors. Okay.
What is the full name of SNPF? Can you write it down for us?
Yes, sure. That's the. It doesn't mean anything. So. So that means short.
Short. Okay.
Neuropeptide. F. And the neuropeptide nomenclature has this weird tradition that they fractionated a bunch of things, and then they say, okay, this is A, B, C, D. Yeah, right? And then the neuropeptide Y, it happened to be the Y fraction, and the name stay.
Yes. So you're unable to mimic the fat. The satellite behavior in star flies if you only have the knockdown in the DM5 glomerulus. So if you make it specific and you don't use the ORCA GAD4 to drive it, so you don't observe this behavior. Have you tried that?
We've done that. Yeah, I mean, that's all done. All the control experiments
okay,
were done.
So you really need to hit them all, like hit all the glomeruli to observe that effect.
Yeah, so what we show is that all you need to do is to knock down tachykinin receptor in the DM5 sensory neurons. And that changed the behavior. It's the same as you knock down tachykinin receptor in the ORCA expressing neurons.
Okay.
Yeah? So, so this is the imaging experiment show that here's the sensitivity curve of the fat animals. And when they are starved, here is the response, right? So there is a depression, and these seem to be consistent with divisive gain control. And if we knock down tachykinin receptor in only these DM5 sensory neurons, these divisive gain control is no longer there. And again, without telling you all the details, you have to take my words for it.
I have one question is about the use of gain control, right? Control typically is when you have a target value and you have some algorithm or a method to control the target value, right? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that you are referring more like the gain modulation rather than gain control, because it's shifted the gain from one okay. to the other. It's not actually you are putting the value in a specific target and controlling that.
What if I argue that there is a target appropriate behavior response?
Okay.
So that.
But not so much related to the response of the glomeruli respect to the other concentration.
Sure, right? True.
So
right.
To the behavior, I may take it.
Yeah.
In terms, of course, you can define it as you like, but typically control is for
sure.
Something, some value of that you can control and you keep it.
Sure.
Based on
algorithms. Yeah. Very good, thank you.
I'm thinking about the sort of specificity of the individual glomeruli controlling the behavior and so forth. Have you ever, and I'm wondering if it's the receptor specifically that's sort of determining the outcome, or if it's the which glomerulus is being innervated. Is it possible to switch the receptor for which odor receptor is under which promoter and see if the regulatory system goes with the receptor identity as opposed to the glomerulus?
Yeah, so there are several ways to respond to your questions. Number one, in the fly, the expression of a given odorant receptor doesn't change the wiring of the system. That's a little bit different from mice. Number two, that we have done those experiments. You could, I think, we done the experiment that we have not a swapping of the receptor, but we can ectopically express a different receptor in a specific sensory neuron class according to the glomerulus map. And so now that you can endow that sensory neurons with ability to respond some other orders, and in that case, that the behavior is exactly as predicted by the wiring of the system, not the receptor that neuron expresses.
Right. Just to make sure we're clear, so the main point you're making is that the wiring in the fly is basically some sort of self-fed determinant which is independent of the receptor identity.
Exactly.
Okay, so some wiring and the receptor happens to be correlated, we put it in that.
Exactly, exactly. So here's...
So there must be some signal that tells that glomerulus to be the one that expresses the short NPF receptor.
Yeah, so if you look at the wiring of the system using the combination of transcription factors, right? So for each of the cell in a class, they are determined by a combination of transcription factors in a spatial-temporal fashion, right? And the expression of a given odin receptor is just very, very downstream of this system, right? Unlike in the mouse, that the expression of a given receptor perhaps kind of perturb the transcription factor combination or something, that, so the wiring is messed up.
Right. Okay. I was thinking also about the wiring, but also the expression of these receptors and whether that was related to which odor receptor was being expressed, determine whether it was the dacokinin or the shortened BF, whatever.
So here's the divisive gain control that mediated by tachykinin, and here's a summary of what we know, that this is a divisive gain control, and tachykinin is released by the GABAergic local interneurons. That's different from the release of SHORN-PF, right? So this is released by the GABAergic local interneurons. It's a co-neurotransmitter. And the expression of tachykinin receptor is also controlled by insulin level. It's only when the animal is hungry that insulin level decline allows the expression of the tachykinin receptor. But tachykinin receptor in this case, it suppresses the terminal sensitivity, leading to less neurotransmitter release and make the synapse depressed.
Yeah, do we know the time scale? How long it takes?
The time scale of starvation?
It says the insulin is released to the expression of it.
Oh, yeah, so we know that this changed as fast as 3 hours. So that, and by the way, it's probably not a coincidence that time scale is consistent with, the 3 meals per day for us. Mm-hmm. And also for insects, some insects are episodic feeders, and some insects are continuous feeders. So, and worms are continuous feeders. So the SHORN-PF or the tachykinin receptor expression in those system will be interesting. And to the more extreme, some of those deer lice, they only eat once in a year. It will be interesting to look at those neuropeptide expression there as well. So that's the two different gain control systems in response to starvation in adult sufferer. And now I'm going to switch gear to talk about another gain control, and this is automatic gain control. So
any thoughts on why you separate the release of tachykinin into the local neurons versus the other situation where it's very
auto? I have no idea. What do you think?
It's more surprising to me that it's from the local neurons, because presumably they're also releasing onto other glomeruli.
Yeah,
but it's just not doing anything about
this. Yeah. So I think So maybe after you see the second part, you may have some new idea about why it's released by the GABA allergic local into neurons. It has something to do with serotonin modulation.
It's a good point, though. However, the neuromodulation in general, and at least the current view, which may be wrong, is that you kind of spit out indiscriminately, and whoever expresses the right receptor then listens.
Let me summarize what we have seen so far. So basically, when an animal is in the starvation state, it doesn't simply like scale up or down the neural activity of the entire olfactory system. It actually upregulated sensitivity of specific glomeruli and downregulated the response of another glomeruli. So for example, I mean specifically that DM1 that oppetitive glomerulus using presynaptic facilitation, and the DM5, the aversive glomerulus, is a presynaptic inhibition mechanism. So the concert effect of the facilitation and inhibition together sculpt the response to food odor. All right. So now I'm going to switch to talk about automatic and control. And I'd like to talk about the pheromone system now. So the in many insect species, there are macroglomeruli. And in Manduca, it is very easy to see because they are distinct. In Drosophila, it is defined by the expression of a gene called FULES. And FULES is a gene that required for all mating behavior. If there's a mutant in this gene, the flies simply don't mate. Okay. So, and this expression is limited to three different glomeruli, both the sensory neurons and the projection neurons. Okay. So the DA1 glomerulus here, and the receptor detect a male pheromone called cis-vaginal acetate. And this activation of this receptor increase female receptivity and inhibit male-male courtship behavior. So this is important for sex discrimination. There was a worse name before, but I'm not going to talk about it. This is when geneticists discover mutations, they have a lot of freedom to name the gene. Another one is that the VL2A, this is one of the IR receptor that it detects food odor, and for fruit flies that their courtship behavior is increased by the presence of food. And the OR47B, they project axons into the VA1LM glomerulus, and recently that a paper was published by Bill Hanson's group identify the ligand is a fatty acid ester. And we have done a lot of work on this, although unpublished here, that we show that fatty acids actually excite these glomeruli, and activation of these glomerulus promotes mating behavior. Yes, three glomeruli. Yeah, so these are three glomeruli here. So here's the data that show that fatty acids promotes mating behavior. So we put a female, wild-type female fly, and together with either a wild-type or a mutant male flies, and we measure how much time it takes for copulation to happen. So take data from many flies, we can see how what's the percentage of flies would exhibit copulation within these 2 hours of observation time. So the mutant that are lacking the receptor for detecting fatty acid or fatty acid esters, they have lower copulation rate. And if we put fatty acid into the entire mating chamber, then the copulation rate increase. And that's only when the male is a wild-type fly. If the male is a mutant fly, fatty acids have no enhancement effect on the copulation rate. Okay, so what I have told you just now is that the fatty acid, they are stimulatory compounds that exist on the cuticle of fruit flies, and these promote mating behavior.
And pheromones are very specific chemicals. And when I hear fatty acids, it sounds extremely general. Is there a specific compound?
I'm not sure I said pheromone.
You didn't say pheromone? You said it in the first sentence.
So I'm going to, yeah.
So it's not a specific chemical.
It's not sex specific.
Certain chain length or saturation or.
Yeah. So the problem, so here's the definition of pheromone, right? I mean, you know that too. Pheromone, by definition, is the chemical excreted by one animal of the species to elicit behavior of a different animal of the conspecific. Right, so the so we have to be, I mean, I don't know what I should call it yet, but we can discuss more. Okay, so and I already mentioned to you that sensory neurons go to glomerulus, and the projection neurons send dendrite into the same glomerulus, and this is also interrupted by many of these GABAergic local interneurons, and their EEM study demonstrated that the sensory neuron makes synapse with projection neuron, and local interneurons also make synapse with both of them, right? So in abstract, you can think that there is a feedback system that the from the output of olfactory sensory neurons, they send information to the GABAergic inhibitory neurons, and GABA is released. And in the presynaptic terminal of sensory neurons, they are GABA B receptor. So this will be a feedback loop. And because the response of the local interneuron, they scale with the output of the sensory neuron, so therefore you have a divisive gain modulation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now, here's the evidence that GABA B receptor actually does so. So this is the time when we did this experiment, we didn't know what's the ligand for this receptor, so we have to use optogenetic stimulation. So we express channel rhodopsin in the OFSMB sensory neurons. So now we can use light to stimulate these neurons. And we recall from the postsynaptic projection neurons. And here's the spike for the output neurons. And then we can look at the response in the animals that have knockdown of GABA B receptor only in the OR47B sensory neurons. So here's the input-output curve that knockdown GABA B receptor increase the slope of this input-output curve. So this is consistent with the idea that GABA B receptor plays a role in divisive gain modulation in this case. So now, I'm going to ask you a question now that I showed you before. The ligand for the OR4SMB receptor promotes courtship behavior. And now I show you that the knockdown of GABA B receptor in the OR4SMB neurons actually increase the sensitivity of the OR4SMB receptor neuron and also the downstream postsynaptic projection neurons. So now the question is, if the male flies have the knockdown of the GABA B receptor, should they increase the copulation rate or decrease the copulation rate? Is a question.
Decrease?
Stays the same. So here's the result. It actually decreased the copulation rate. So Why is that? So I have two favorable hypotheses, and maybe you have more to tell me as well. That one possibility is that the dynamic range of the projection neurons is very important. If you have a very, very narrow dynamic range, the male flies does not know where is the female fly. And by the way, this experiment all done in the dark. So there's no visual cue. So odor and touch will be the only, or auditory will be the only mechanism for the flies to sense the presence of the female fly. So a narrow dynamic range would have a problem because the because when the male fly get near the female fly and not at the female flies yet, the response is already saturated. So therefore, in the last 5 millimeter, perhaps, the male fly simply cannot know with certainty where is the female fly. And another possibility is that because the nature of GABA-B receptor is a metabotropic receptor, and it has a time scale. The effect of activation of GABA-B receptor lasts for seconds to minutes, right? So as the male fly walk close to the female fly, he's basically resetting the baseline for the response every once in a while or continuously. So that allow, again, a larger dynamic range. And we haven't done any experiments, so I don't have an answer to discriminate between these two hypotheses. Maybe you have other one as well. You can tell me later.
But Jim, if you go back to the previous slide, it was similar to me. Something's puzzling here that, you know, you go all the way from essentially 0 to 100%, whatever you're calling stimulus intensity. There's no evidence of saturation in either case, so it's...
Yeah, we just probably didn't do the experiment to...
So they're just, you know, I'm just saying it seems like it's... what would you call it? So that you're actually resetting the maximum firing rate, which is known essentially, right?
Well, eventually, if we go...
But
well,
how can you go beyond 100%? That's my worry.
Well, switch the light bulb, right? So I mean that's the only way we can do. So because the light bulb, because the
so this is not 100% is the maximum. So I think it's, okay, you just didn't go to the saturation. I think that seems like if you want to really define carefully, maybe going back to what Ramon was saying,
yeah,
you really want the whole curve, right?
Yeah. So we need to find the saturation point. Very
okay.
Good point.
Okay.
Yeah. This is
Because I think in the dynamic range that seems like you need that to be really sure. Because if you look at it here, it looks like they're both doing fine.
Yeah.
In the range.
Yeah. So the okay. So all right. So that's the all right. So this GABA mediated feedback gain control has another very interesting feature, is that different glomerular sensory neurons, they have different expression level of GABA B receptor. So therefore, there is a heterogeneity of the different gain modulation. For example, the CO2 sensory neuron, sensing sensory neurons, they absolutely do not have GABA B receptor expression. So therefore, they are not sensitive to GABA, at least in the presynaptic terminal. And for the pheromone sensing glomeruli, their sensory neuron have very high level expression of GABA B receptor, so the gain modulation is very big. And there are other glomeruli that sensitivity to GABA is intermediate, and so.
Didn't need to try to block GABA A.
GABA A receptor is somehow elusive. We don't know where it is expressed. GABA B receptor, we know with certainty it is expressed in the presynaptic terminal. And we also know with certainty that GABA A receptor is not expressed in the presynaptic terminal. But when you put in picotoxin, and picotoxin is thought to block GABA A receptor, and picotoxin does have effect on the response of projection neurons. So therefore, it's there. It's just that I don't know where exactly is it. Maybe there are some new papers. I'm not sure that whether I missed anything.
Something I've never actually understood about these gain control via these ganglomerular lenses. Specificity of gain control on a glomerulus to glomerulus basis. I mean, if you activate an LN, it inhibits the local glomerulus. Mm-hmm. Isn't it also leading over to other channels that you may not necessarily want gain control to happen because there are new inhibitors?
Yeah, so certainly there are intraglomerular versus interglomerular.
So it's very complicated.
Effect,
right?
Yeah. Very interesting. I think in a few slides you're going to see something along that line. Yeah, and the other thing I want to mention is that Rachel Wilson's laboratory, they have done work to show that gain modulation in the antenna lobe is mostly input gain control, input gain modulation. And they have done simulation to show that that's the case. I think both mixture of experiments and modeling work to show that the input gain control, right, the control on the sensory neurons is the most critical gain modulation in the antenna lobe. All right, so that's, as if this is not complicated enough, that serotonin also makes contribution. And serotonin, this is a pair of serotoninergic neurons that there's one cell body on each side of the antenna lobe. These neurons have very elaborated innervation all over the olfactory system in the lateral horn and somewhere near the mushroom body and also in the antenna lobe. But the immunostaining studies show that 5-HT is only present at the antenna lobe. So therefore, people think this is a descending neurons in the fly olfactory systems. So the dendroid is in the high brain center, the lateral horn, or the Martian body, and the release of serotonin is then in the antenna lobe. So now I'm going to show you some work that we have done that serotonin increase the sensitivity of the GABAergic local interneurons. So here's by calcium imaging, and that's before and after the application of serotonin. So this is before and this is after. So local interneurons become more sensitive to all the stimulation in the presence of serotonin. And the local interneurons, yes?
That is the entire antenna lobe imaged. Just a single local neuron or a bunch of local neurons?
I think it's a bunch.
Okay.
Yeah, but I could be wrong. But I don't remember that we actually did a flip out experiment to label a single local interneurons.
It doesn't look very regional. Is that accurate impression?
Doesn't look very. So I think it has something to do with, I mean, this picture here is not very dense.
Yes.
I guess you should take the difference, right, in both control and.
Yeah.
So you're saying it is not regional or it is regional?
It doesn't look super.
It doesn't, yeah. It looks more or less everywhere.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
This is local interneurons, right?
Yeah.
But if you have made a difference, then you can see more regions. Right?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. So, and then we look at the effect of serotonin on the presynaptic release. So we use a synaptophorin, and then measure neurotransmitter release, right? So now that Okay, so here is the control. If we put in serotonin, then the neurotransmitter release from the presynaptic terminal is reduced, right? And now if we block this with GABA-B receptor antagonist, then serotonin has no effect. So that means that serotonin upregulates the sensitivity of local interneurons, and that affects the presynaptic release, suppress the presynaptic release. Okay, so this is the picture that we think that this feedback inhibition, the level of feedback inhibition, is controlled by serotonin. So hence, there's a global control and there's a private control. The private control is achieved by the differential expression of GABA-B receptor in the presynaptic terminal of individual glomeruli. And global gain control is done by release of serotonin from the descending serotoninergic neurons into the antennal lobe. So,
is that something specific, or could it be that it does more than just global gain control?
Does more than global gain control? You mean whether serotonin release, whether serotonin is can affect specific glomeruli? That's what you're asking.
Specific interneurons.
You could be. We have no idea at this moment that which GABAergic local interneurons express serotonin receptor. In fact, we don't even know which serotonin receptor is expressed there. There are about 4 or 5 serotonin receptors, and we don't know which one is expressed in which local GABAergic interneuron. So until then,
how many fibers are there carrying serotonin?
How many fibers there?
I mean,
you have a picture now. There's a couple of pictures there. It looks pretty much everywhere, right? Didn't you show a picture of the serotonin? No, before.
Before this one?
Yeah.
This is the serotonin release neuron.
That's what you want to know.
But right. He's asking for the neuron. I saw you asking for how many local, how many GABAergic.
I was asking how many.
There's only 2 neurons.
There are only 2 neurons. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a fireman.
There are 2 neurons.
You know, the serotonergic neuron.
And there's no
serotonergic neuron.
And then when you put serotonin in there, I mean, you put an antibody for serotonin, right? And this neuron can account for all of the serotonin immunostaining. So therefore, there's no other serotonin neurons at the present in the antenna lobe.
But I thought you were making the point that even if the activation of the interneuron is effectively global, indiscriminate, by the selective expression of GABA-B receptor, you can still get non-global effects, right?
Exactly. That's the point. So
you
want to
know if there's an addition, there's some.
Right. Right. So that's the point I want to make. There's a global and private input gain modulation in the olfactory glomeruli in the fly brain. And, you know, it's remarkable that despite there's so much difference in the morphological organization of the fly versus mammalian olfactory system, and despite that, the neurotransmitter between the sensory neuron and the postsynaptic cells are different. In mouse, this is glutamate. In fly, acetylcholine. But when you look at the neuromodulators, there is a lot of conservation. And so here's the descending neuron in the fly, that's the CSD neuron. In the mouse, that's the descending neuron from the Raffi nuclei that Venki has worked before. And they release serotonin, and serotonin in the fly olfactory system that increase the sensitivity of the local interneurons. And in mouse, is that still true? That is the periglomerular cells?
What is true?
That the receptor of the 5-HT is present in the periglomerulus.
But not only, I would say, I think John may have something to say. So I think it's probably in all the glomerular neurons, not just that.
Not just that, okay.
But it includes them.
Includes that one, okay. And these release GABA, and GABA modulated the presynaptic terminal sensitivity, and that was our work for the GABA B receptor was inspired by Jiang's paper before us. And finally, I'm just going to say that the modulation by serotonin has another complexity, that despite the increase, the sensitivity of the local interneurons, it also increases, we don't know how, the olfactory sensitivity of projection neurons. Okay, so when we use private odors that excite just one or two glomeruli, we can put in serotonin and see that the response is actually increased. Because when we use private odor, we want to eliminate or we want to reduce the interaction between different glomeruli, and this is the case. So so with each of the glomeruli that we have tried, that serotonin seemed to increase their sensitivity. And now, here's the fun part. So now that you can use a complex odor, I mean not a complex odor, an odor that excites multiple glomeruli, and then you can ask the question, how does the pattern of response is altered by the presence of serotonin? So what we saw is that the contrast of glomerular pattern is actually increased.
It's really scary. We actually have a paper on the revision in mouse, which the mitral cells does almost exactly this. We should talk. So it sensitizes, and there's basically decorrelation.
Yeah. Well, we're not. Yeah, we can talk.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Okay. So. Okay. So I'm just going to close by saying that.
This is just for Ramon, right?
Yeah, as we probe the circuit function of the olfactory system, that I think that engineering principle can give a lot of hint about how to approach the problem, and looks to me that the feedback circuit in the olfactory system seems to function as a PID. A proportional integral derivative controller system. So basically for this PID, it has three terms, right? One is the P, that is the present error. And the I is the integration of past error. And D is the derivative of the current error. So, but it's very difficult to put set point into the system here. But the question is that what is the purpose of the feedback system? So if we understand what's the purpose of the feedback system, then we probably would understand what is the set point, right? So the so if we look at the behavior, if you look at the behavior of the animal, so maybe there is a prefer or there is a goal for the behavior. So if you want to be attractive to something but not obsessive with something, right? So you need to tune all of these parameters. So I would say that in the feedback system, the error is already the P value is determined by the expression level of the GABA B receptor, right? And because it's a GABA B receptor, it's a metabotropic receptor, and also the one that I showed before, tachykinin receptor, is also a metabotropic receptor. So perhaps tachykinin receptor and the Schwann-PF receptor, or the GABA B receptor, they work at different time scale and to address the requirement of the time integration. And where's the derivative coming from? I don't know. Maybe that come from the olfactory sensory neuron that Matthew talked about the other day, that the olfactory receptor neuron actually responds to the gradient rather than odor concentration, right? The gradient of the change. I haven't mentioned body because Glenn is going to talk about mushroom body, so I didn't want to.
But the arrows signal, you know, who computes that? Computes that is fairly complicated, right? It should be higher up, right?
Okay. Okay. So you think that the mushroom body
should be there?
Okay. Right. Where do you want to? Where do you want to put it?
Let's wait for Glenn.
Okay, so I'm going to just thank the people who did the work, and this is all the, my lab's not that big, okay, so the only, this is all the past and the current people that make a contribution to this work, and collaborator, and funding from all of the years. Okay, thank you.
I mean, you talk about gain control, but you also mentioned that the levels of GABA-B receptors are different for different receptor neurons. So it may be that there is more subtle kind of computation that this feedback performs. So I guess my question is whether you can see the effect of plasticity. I mean, even on the level of gain control, the gain can change in the human experience. What have you thought about at all?
Very. Are you, yeah, so so here's a question too, that we have been, I mean, at least I've been growing up with the belief that memory is stored in synaptic weight and stored in the monosynaptic plasticity as the mechanism. And then when I look at the gain control system, and I thought, would that be a possibility that basically memory just extend of this integration of time of the past experience, and somehow through the neuromodulation system, it can change the circuit function. And
that's true, but it's more short term, I mean, so more activity based. Memory. I mean, that integral is, that you write there, is integral of activity, right?
Yes. So if you...
The question is whether the synaptic strength in that feedback neuron can somehow be changed by experience.
Right. So if you figure out the molecular mechanism to implement the integration of time, and it's probably through some kind of effector, right? Some kind of ion channels, and you can assume that, suppose that experience can hijack that effector and turn that into a long-lasting effector. Therefore, you have memory that lasts for much longer time scale. It's possible, right? I'm very glad you mentioned that.
No, but I guess you contrast, I mean, you mentioned that you think the integral is computed because it's only the product. It's a very slow receptor.
Right, right.
And that more kind of, in my mind, that maps more into short-term memory?
Yes, sure.
Than the long-term memory, which would be the change in the number of receptors.
I totally agree that the metabotropic receptor is a short-term time scale, in the time scale of minutes. But the metabotropic receptor eventually have to work through an effector channel, such as a sodium channel, potassium channel, something like that. And so, presumably that you know, experience can just go directly to hijack the effector. So what if you have a long-lasting covalent modification of the effector channel, and then suddenly that this effect will last for a long time? I mean, I'm making it up.
That's an easy experiment, because if you just bang the synapse with some kind of stimulus,
yes,
you can see whether there is long-term.
Yeah. Oh, in theory. In theory.
I'm sure you should at least say relatively.
Yeah.
Because the shortest way of getting an experimentalist not to do the experiment, when you say, like, well, that's an easy
just say straightforward. I have a question. So it really is striking all the similarities between the circuit between the mouse and the fly. But there's sort of a mystery that I think not everyone agrees with me is a mystery in the mouse, that in addition to having this GABAergic circuit, there's also these dopaminergic paraglomerular cells in that paraglomerular ring. And there's also dopamine D2 receptors on the presynaptic terminal, and they exhibit long-term experience-dependent plasticity. And the literature basically waves its hands and says, oh, it also does some kind of adaptive gain control through some kind of presynaptic mechanism, ... But it's a pretty unsatisfying literature. Is there anything analogous to that in the fly?
Yeah, I didn't put that slide on to scare you. But we did a transcriptome analysis from the nose. We basically chop out the antennae.
Yeah.
So we cut out the antennae from maybe 1,000 or 2,000 flies.
Wow.
And then we run the transcriptome analysis, compare staff and fat flies.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw 41 GPCRs, their expression is up and down regulated. And that includes like 4 dopamine receptor, 3 octopamine receptor, and a bunch of neuropeptide receptors and all of that. So we have 41. So it'll be interesting. I think it's scary, but it'll be interesting to look at the expression pattern of all of these 41 GPCRs, map them out onto the individual glomeruli. And we are doing that. But
Jimmy, since you're kind of like an enemy now, right? Because the people doing connectomes, if you have the connection installed, where does all this GPCR modulation? I'm being cynical. But the connection diagram was everything, and you're done. So.
Yeah, so the...
What's the static connection diagram of the average fly?
Yeah, and also, I mean, the... anyhow, that's...
Yeah, but I'm sure that things change on that.
Cool. That's
awesome. Okay. We have 10 minutes,
Blake. Thank you so much.